This is the Elevate Podcast, where trial lawyers learn, share, and grow. Let's talk about how we can elevate our trial practices, law firms, and lives. And now, here are your hosts, coming to you from coast to coast, trial lawyers Ben Gideon and Rahul Ravipudi.
Today's episode of the Elevate Podcast is being brought to you by Smart Advocate. Smart Advocate is award-winning case management software used to manage personal injury, medical malpractice, MDL, class action law firms all over the United States. Great program, highly recommend it. Check them out at smartadvocate.com. Today's episode is being brought to you by Expert Institute. Expert Institute is the place to go for everything involving experts to help you win your case. Check them out at expertinstitute.com. And today's episode is being brought to you by Hype Legal. Hype Legal is a one-stop shop for all of your digital marketing needs. Check them out at hypelegal.com.
Welcome to the Elevate Podcast. I'm Rahul Ravipudi.
And I'm Ben Gideon.
Ben, so we were off the record talking about our summertime workout schedules, and yours had got me in awe. So what exactly are you doing over this summer to stay in shape?
So I've, I think I might start training for a triathlon. I've been doing the swim and the bike legs of that. And I started swimming in the ocean right behind my house every morning, which I was a little worried about because we had a great white shark attack just a couple miles away from where I live a couple summers ago, where a woman was killed swimming in a wetsuit. But you know what? I think you're much more likely to get hit by a truck riding your bike than eaten by a great white shark while you're swimming. Still, the psychology of it isn't great. How about you? I know you've been out running with your son now regularly. Tell me about that.
I have. It's been a psychological battle. I've got my 13-year-old son, which I've been trying to get into running. And every morning about 5:30 in the morning, he's mad at me. And during the runs, which are anywhere from 2 to 6 miles, he's mad at me. And then when he's done, he says he doesn't want to do it tomorrow. And there we go. Rinse and repeat.
So this is like a forced compulsion project for him. He doesn't have any free will in it?
No free will. He's acknowledged that and he's upset about that. And I've just been trying to teach him maybe rightly or wrongly about mental discipline and toughness and actually doing something that is hard, but you just need to do. And maybe in 25 years, he'll thank me for it or he'll stop talking to me. I don't know which one's going to come first. So I'm looking forward to seeing our guest and you, Ben, at the PSBR Trial College July 28th here in Marina Del Rey. I've had the pleasure of being a student of Roger Dodd, and I still talk about it, I don't want to say daily, but almost daily with everybody that I have a chance to share that they need to learn from this man, because his cross-examination techniques are unique and incredibly effective. So Roger, thanks so much for joining us.
You bet. My pleasure.
So before we jump into the technique and the skills of cross-examination, which I'm really curious to hear about, can you just tell us a little bit more about your background? I mean, you definitely have this fascinating career where you've not only worked as a trial lawyer across the country in multiple different states, but you've actually appeared on some very well-known shows, including Geraldo and Court TV, as a commentator. How did you get into that?
It's a lot like trial work. You take the first one, somebody sees you and says, hey, I want you to do that over here. And that's how it worked with the lecturing. That's how it worked with cases, with writing. It's how it works with the appearances. Geraldo, by far, is a fun guy.
What were you doing on his show?
Just commenting on a couple cases. I forget what it was. I think it was a murder case, murder for hire, $3 million life insurance policy. They leave all the cookie crumbs on the computer about how they look up how to kill someone and stuff. A day at work. You know, I've tried a bunch of death penalty cases, so I guess that qualifies me in, I don't know, 30, 40 murder cases. And lately, we've done a lot more civil work the last 10 years or so. Criminals just don't have the resources anymore. Occasionally, you get one that's a really good one. We had 14 pounds of crack cocaine in Utah. That made us very popular with the entire state. And they had to turn them loose. That just very brave judge, very ugly community reaction.
There aren't that many civil trial lawyers today that still do criminal cases. Do you still take them? And which type of case do you prefer?
Well, we do still take them. You know, I was on a court-appointed list in Georgia. You had to serve 5 years or 6 years, whatever it was. I was on it for like 26 years. I enjoy those people. I mean, they're not your civil clients. It gives you a bigger picture of the world. Not to say they're bad or worse or better. They're just different. So we still do take them. Hell, I took a DUI case recently because it was a relative, a distant relative, but it was a relative. I did not need his mother yelling at me about not trying to help him. And so if it's a case that we think we make a difference in, then we're interested. Economic reality is a lot more money in PI work, a lot more demand. Personally, I think that there are not that many trial lawyers left, real trial lawyers, who will wade in and say, okay, let's go try the case. So as long as the next generations are not building trial lawyers, then we're going to stay employed, all of us, all three of us.
Do you think that the criminal cases have honed your trial skills in a way that just if you solely did civil cases that you wouldn't have developed?
Yeah, I think so. I do, particularly cross-examination and opening statements. If you didn't know how to cross first 15 years of my practice, I would have died. And I did it every way you could do wrong. You know, life is a process of elimination. I just kept eliminating things that didn't work until we got to the things that did work. And then we tried to whittle that down to an understandable set of guidelines, rules that would work in the heat of battle and that you could remember, that you could execute. Anybody give you a trial technique that's complicated, shoot that person, because they're setting you up for failure. You look at the best educators around, not just in trial work. They make the subject matter easy to perform. And everybody loves that. Well, juries do too. Juries want to get it right. We need to be good teachers in the courtroom. Not so much good trial lawyers, good teachers. Then you'll get the verdicts that we all like to get.
Roger, just touching on one of the comments you made that the trial lawyers is a sort of dying breed. Why do you think that is?
It's hard work. I think that's the biggest problem. We get people in to intern or, you know, want to be mentored for a while. I can't get their ass to work. You know, they've come to me, asked me, I agree to help, and then they're lazy. Now, beyond that, when I first started trying cases, maybe a third, maybe 25% went to a jury. The percentage is down to less than 1% now. So the whole system is now rigged not to go to trial. That's not a good thing or a bad thing, but it's a real thing. And reality is, if you don't get in the courtroom and you don't try cases, fear incapacitates you. The fear builds up to the point where people are afraid to go to court. And just recently, I was involved in a case. I won't name the case or the guy. He's a really, really nice man. He's been a partner in a high building firm. Lots of people. And he's been a partner for 11 years. I don't know how long he's practiced, probably close to 20. And he's had 11 jury trials. How do you get good with 11 over that period of time? And what was even more amazing was the trial judge had tried one jury trial in the preceding 16 months. Now, how do you get good at being a trial judge? And his rulings were, they were very, very accurate, but they were excruciatingly slow. And listen, you're going to run jurors out of the block if that's what you're doing. They already think we take too much time, and we probably do. Now, give me a judge who has to go slow motion because he has to look stuff up all the time. I'm not going to be able to keep my jurors' attention. So the system's rigged not to go try the case. And again, we just settled a case yesterday, and it is a fine settlement for the client. I'm personally disappointed. I wanted to cross-examine the defendant. Best interest of the client, we settle the case. It's not what I like to do. It's not what I want to do. What I feel like I ethically have to do. I couldn't look that lady in the eye and say, I can beat that offer. So as trial lawyers, we all do the same thing. You're honest with them and they go, I don't want to take that chance. I don't want to take that risk. And you know what? If it was my case, I'd probably vote the same way she did. But as a trial lawyer, I want to go do trials. You know, the clinic helps keep your skills up a little bit. It's not the same as a trial, but it helps. Even as a participant or an instructor, it helps. And there's nothing else out there, so you have to do those kind of stuff now. The days of sitting in a lecture hall and listening, those are over. For real trial lawyers, those are over.
So we're going to get into your cross-examination techniques, but before we do that, I'm interested. You and your partner, Trish, who we've had on the show, and she was fantastic.
She is a great trial lawyer. She really is.
Yeah, I mean, you can definitely tell that just even on the podcast.
Well, she does stuff that I look up and go, okay, on my best day, I can't do that. That is not working with this body. And she just does it naturally, and juries absolutely adore. They're rapt, paying rapt attention when she's talking.
So you guys have kind of a focus in the seminars you do, and I know you do them all over the country, on cross-examination. Is that because you believe that cross is the most important part of the trial, or is that just the area you've decided to focus on?
Well, it not only is my belief, it is reality. If you can win your crosses, you'll win your cases. I don't see any juror being motivated by a direct examination. It's all self-serving. Every bit of it is. And it is by nature that. Plaintiffs' lawyers love to hire experts. You know, you got a problem, hire another expert. They almost always cancel out unless you can cross the other guy's expert. Now, I will admit, voir dire is very important, and we do teach some of that. But I think cross is even more important. And it's more important now because you're not getting to the jury. So now you have to do your cross-examination in depositions. So 5 years ago, maybe 8 years ago, probably 8 years ago, I came up with the design of I'm crossing at depositions the same way I do a trial. No more of this crap of open-ended, what happened next. I don't need that. I got that most of the time. What I want to do is get verbal requests for admissions during the depositions, whether they're designated to be used at trial or not. I'm still doing it the same way. Now, there's going to be some open-ended, but most of it's going to be cross. Then I'm going to use the cross to negotiate at mediation, to use as selling points at mediation. Your guy said this. He can't live with that on his stand. I'm going to tear him apart. That's what makes cases settle. Again, it goes back to the fear in the opponent. If the opponent knows you can cross and will show up, then their fear level goes way up.
Do you think that you become a victim of your own success in the sense that you're so effective doing that at depositions that nobody wants to try the case at that point because you've already won it?
It's reality anyhow, Ben. You know, when you tell me 1 out of 100 going to trial, and I suspect that's not even accurate. I suspect that's too high. Just because everybody I talk with, no one's getting to trial.
Except Rahul has had about 4 in the last 3 weeks. But
well, he's such a nice guy. Everybody thinks that he's going to be nice at trial. They don't understand how mean he can get. Of course, making your child get up at 5:30 in the morning so that 25 years from now, he might be a good person. That shows meanness, too.
I play the long game, Roger.
Hey, listen, so. I'm with your child. If he calls, I'll represent him. And I like getting up early in the morning, but he needs a little bit of free will.
Gets that from 2 to 3 p.m.
Well, yeah, he's probably going to be a very productive psychotic citizen.
So you're teaching a seminar at the PSBR Trial College in advanced cross-examination. Can you give our listeners a little preview of what they might learn if they were to go attend that seminar and just kind of whet everyone's appetite for that?
Well, on Saturday morning, Trish, my partner, and I are going to, in real time, critique Brian Panish's crosses.
When you say real time, do you mean he's going to be doing one live or you're going to be critiquing one he's already done?
Either way. And I think what the plan is, I haven't really been following it. I've been working on a case, is that they're going to have clips either of trial questioning, cross-examination, or deposition cross-examination. And we'll suggest, and what I mean by real time, we're not going to watch them ahead of time. It's not going to be scripted. I hate that when people let me see your tape and let me watch it five times, and then I'm going to critique you. Okay. Well, any chimpanzee can do that, right? You have enough preparation time. That's not fair to the person performing. Person performing is doing it in real time. They don't have five takes. So I think the critique should be in real time too. Then we're going to say the things we really like about it, say the things we think he can improve on. And as both of you know, Panish is, I've said this before publicly, and Keith Mitnick makes him crazy to hear it, so I'll say it again. Panish is a generational lawyer on cross. You're going to see a couple more of those, but it's like Michael Jordan. He's going to do stuff intuitively that most of us could plan and not pull off. He has such a good sense of how to listen. And he's an example I always give to people. The best cross-examiners in the world are the best listeners, not the best talkers, the best listeners, because that witness is going to open a door for you. And that's the turning point in the case. And everybody feels it. They don't know it. They don't see it. They don't hear it. They feel it. And the jury has this now, has this empowerment of that was important. And I know what I'm going to do now. He has that ability. And I'll say this for him. He's willing to get critiqued in front of anybody. And that I think that's hard. When you get to y'all's level, Panish's level, there's a natural defense mechanism that goes up and says, please, Lord, don't let me throw up on my boots in front of all these people. You know, I'm supposed to be somebody. Please don't let somebody figure out that I'm really, you know, a scared little eighth grader. He's fearless about the critique. And I always say I won't do it unless the person asks me personally to do it, because otherwise it's not fair in front of that many people. And he called and said, would you mind doing it? I said, I'll do it if Trish can do it as well. And the reason we like two critiquers, there's two points of view. One's younger, one's attractive, one's a female, and then there's me. So you get both ends of the spectrum. But yeah, that should be exciting. I absolutely am excited about doing it. I don't mind lecturing, but I'd much rather critique in person. And I think it's more spontaneous with the audience. There's a lot more to be learned that way than something that's already scripted.
So when Trish was on, she gave us the three core rules, which I think were short questions with leading questions with one idea per question and going from the general down to the specific. Is that what it was?
Almost got it right. Not topics, not areas, not ideas. One little detailed fact. At the level you guys are trying cases at, you cannot beat an expert unless you factually beat him one little fact at a time. I saw Raul when we were together, working together, ripped up an expert witness. And the only thing he was doing right was one little fact at a time until the guy got to the point where he ran out of road. There was a dead end. If he was in a car, he would have gotten thrown out of the vehicle. And he did it just because of that. And he was doing it because he was listening and he was catching himself. He'd say, well, what about, and he'd have two or three little facts in there. He'd say, wait a minute, let me back up and fix it. And every time he did that, this witness, who's a professional witness, would get this look on his face like, oh, this is going to be a bad day. Right. And that's what drives verdicts, in my opinion.
Beyond that, those three basic points, which although seem simple, are actually more, I guess, profound than you think. Once you start to try to do that, because you realize, even though you think you might be good at cross, you're actually not doing it that way consistently every time. I've noticed in my own crosses that happens. Beyond that, are there other things that we should be looking out for in structuring a good cross? Doing those three points, also listening, obviously, to answers carefully. But you know, I think a lot about when I'm trying to plan a cross of, I do mostly medical cases, so docs that are very sophisticated, you know, full Harvard professor and fellowship trained and, you know, authored 10,000 articles on the subject that we're crossing them on, you know, you're not going to win the battle if you start to get into the weeds of the area they've spent their lifetime learning about. And there can be a lot of risks there to kind of entering that, joining battle with them there. And you're always looking for that point of leverage, like where do you have something that's significant to your case, but also something where you can make elicit that feeling, as you said, where the kind of air comes out of the courtroom and you know there's kind of a turning point. How do you find those things? Sometimes you look and you don't see any openings and you wonder, what should I do now? Because yeah. I don't see it. You know, I can go one question at a time, one fact at a time, and I'm just going to put the rope out there. It's going to be longer. I'm going to hang myself and it's going to take a longer time now. But how do you find that opening that really makes that difference?
Preparation is a lot more important than presentation. We all like to think we're cool in the courtroom. I'm involved in a case right now where there are 50,000 documents, 50,000 documents. We have a lawyer who went through 50,000 documents. And she found stuff that I'll be darned anybody else found. Now, how much time she spent on it? Hours, days. But that's where it comes from. Preparation is the be all. We can talk about everything else in the courtroom and we all like to look good. It's the preparation. And you're right. You don't want in the weeds. You want in the significant stuff where this doctor, in your case, who's written 10,000 articles, has never written on this because this is the most important thing in this case. And he's written about other stuff. And he wants to talk about the other stuff. And he wants to talk about Harvard. He don't want to talk about how hard it is to do something and do it right under pressure. And to me, that's where you get them almost all the time. Get them into reality. What happened in this case? Don't tell me how smart you are. Tell me what happened here. Tell me why the doctor went through a red flag. Why didn't the doctor just stop? Why didn't he take a timeout? It works for kids, but he went through the red flag and now we have a bad result. So when you say, I looked, I didn't see anything. If you're going to take the case, look harder, look deeper. Then expand your field. Don't just focus on this is what happened. This is what I got across on. What about everything else that was involved? Because nothing happens in a vacuum. These defendant doctors do not operate in a vacuum. They have real lives. They have children that get in trouble. They have distractions. They have all this other stuff. You have to go find it all. I mean, we were involved in a medical case in Georgia where literally, because we had a person on the inside of the office who was unhappy with the doctor, left the doctor, they leaked to us that he and his wife had had a big fight the morning of this surgery. At first, we didn't believe it. We thought, this is a setup. This isn't working. But I got him in deposition to admit that he was upset that morning. And you know, he'd have never admitted that trial. He'd have never admitted it at trial. His lawyer would have had him so prepped for that, but we got him to admit it at the deposition. And that's what we call the can opener. We just got a little piece into that can. Once you get that little hole in, the hole tends to explode. That's why you're listening, because he's going to say something worse. And then he started telling me how it really wasn't that big a fight. And man, we weren't talking about medical malpractice anymore. We're talking about a fight. How big is the fight? How angry were you? How's your blood pressure? Juries could understand that. And the other side knew it. And they did the right thing by the patient. Now, I don't think they'd ever done the right thing had we not found out about that fight. So it's always microscopic. You know, you get into such detail, but you also have to look at the big picture and say, what else was going on here? What else was involved here? And there's almost always a what else.
What's your favorite type of case to handle, Roger? I know you've done so many trials, you can't even keep count, or maybe you can, but of the whole array, is there any particular one where you would love to revisit and do more of those?
Yeah, I mean, before I went to law school, I drove a truck. I was a truck driver. And I know a lot about truck driving. I know all the bad things because we did all the bad things. This is before electronic log books and all that. I mean, I had three sets of books personally. I don't know how many other people have, but I still like doing trucking cases. They're complicated. They're dangerous. I think it's a menace. More trucks on the road than ever. Still enjoy doing those. But it really, for me, it always comes down to the personality of the clients. I'm fascinated by how well people do after they're injured. They do so much better than I think I would if I had the similar injury, or how well their family does after a death. I know they do that better than I've done it. So I think that's really kind of, and I think the juries can see that. They can feel that. They feel the plaintiff. And, you know, if you have a plaintiff who's a charlatan, well, they're going to feel that too. But if you have a good person, man, they're going to do the right thing by them. I believe in juries. And I don't just say that. You know, I'm a trial lawyer. I believe in juries. I've seen juries get it right with terrible lawyer performances on both sides. And they still get it right. They get past the trial stuff. And they get to the right results, sometimes for the wrong reasons. But whoever came up with jurors, I'd say that's one of those great inventions that no one ever talks about, takes for granted.
Have you seen them get it wrong?
Yeah, occasionally. As soon as you said that, I have a case right here, you know, that's still bugging me 20 years later. And I can't decide if I just screwed the case up completely or if the jury just got it wrong. And I have a good friend who's a psychologist. He says, do you think maybe it's a little bit of both? And that's probably right. Still haunts me. Still, I think about it and I end up shaking my head like this because I want that one back. I think I could do a better job than I did. And I still don't understand why the jury did what they did. But
how do you handle losing?
Not well. When I was younger, healthier, I would wash away my blues. And I realized that that is a real trap for trial lawyers. If you're losing or you have a bad day and you're going to do a lot of drinking, you're going to have another bad day. Now, I get real quiet now. I've asked people to leave the house. Don't kick the cat. Don't yell at the dog anymore. But I get real quiet. And then I go through the most painful part of being a trial lawyer, the postmortem. What could we have done better? What could we improve on? Can we get another shot at this one? That's always painful, but I think educational. I think it's, we incorporate it in the firms I'm a partner in. We have mandatory sit-down debriefs, and those are painful. That's just painful as hell, I think. But if you're going to get better, you have to do that. It's like watching the game film after a game, man. You do a bad play, that coach is running that thing back 20 times to show you how bad that play was. Makes you a better player. So we incorporate that. And that's part of the That's part of the process. Particularly, what can we do better? What have we learned from this? How would we do it differently next time?
What's the hardest witness you've ever had to cross?
I literally had a Catholic nun in South Georgia in her regalia with a little silver cross, you know, dangling from her waist. And the only good part of that cross was it was short. She impaled me so many times in such a short period of time that I looked up at the judge, and he's passed away now, of course, but he had his hands like this, and he was shaking his head. And I realized everybody else in the courtroom was too. That was a very, very difficult witness, and I wouldn't sign up to do that again voluntarily. I cross-examined what we thought was a co-defendant in a murder case, unindicted. They never got that right. And I wanted him to say that my client really wasn't the aggressor. And we were doing fine. And out of the blue, he just started yelling, "I told Bobby, you crazy, Bobby." And he said that like 20 times. I mean, it is such a flame out and burn and crash that my grandchildren have heard stories about it and make fun of me about it. They'll come up to me like at Christmas and say, "Hey, have you seen Bobby lately? You know that Bobby? Bobby's crazy." That was a terrible witness, and a lot of it is my fault. I was jumping to conclusions, and he wasn't educated, but he was street smart, and he knew I was jumping ahead. And he just very calmly wouldn't go there. And then he volunteered that. And, of course, the prosecutor used it in his closing argument. So that's the best thing about a good opponent. They will find the flaw in your case, and you will hear about it in closing argument. So if you ever didn't think that was important, you now know that was really important. But, yeah, those two come to mind right away.
We'd like to thank the sponsors of the Elevate podcast, Steno, National Court Reporting Service that allows trial lawyers to defer the costs of court reporting until the end of the case. Take a look, steno.com. And by Law Pods. Law Pods is the podcast production company that we use to produce the show that produces podcasts for lawyers all over the country. They have an expertise in podcasting and the law. Check them out at lawpods.com. What's the most effective cross-examination you've seen, whether it's one you've done or one you've watched somebody else do?
Yeah, without a doubt, it was Bobby Lee Cook in a federal case in Georgia. I might have been practicing 2 years, and he kind of, for reasons I never figured out, kind of befriended me. And I got to watch him cross-examine someone to the point where the jury would not look at the witness. And the only question was, would he ever stop? He was so effective, and it could have gone on for a longer period of time. That probably will always be in my mind the best cross I ever saw. And Mr. Cook was very humble about it. You talk about someone who could try a case. He could cross-examine. That's one end of the spectrum. And he could voir dire like crazy, the other end of the spectrum. Completely opposite skill sets. And he could do both to the point where you go, damn. Yeah, that was a great one. Emery Walters was a great one. I saw him cross-examine a teenager to the point when there's a recess in the middle of the cross and Emery was outside and he had a green sports coat on for whatever reason. I don't know why he had it on for trial, but he wasn't in the courtroom and the witness comes back in and turns to the bailiff and says, "Is that man in the green jacket coming back?" And I thought, oh, yeah, you know you're being crossed. Emery Walters, you never hear that name. It's not a famous name outside the state of Georgia. And in a generation, there'll be nobody left to be remembered by, but I would put him up in the top five I've ever seen. He was generational. And one thing about the really, really good ones, they are so kind to younger, less experienced lawyers. They go out of their way to teach. They go out of their way to make sure that you got the learning point. Yeah, Bill Shepard out of Jacksonville, he just passed away. He's a phenomenal cross-examiner. But all three of those have something in common now. They're all passed away. And I don't see anybody coming around to replace them. And if you don't get enough skills, you don't get enough trial work, I don't know you get that good. You know, who's the best shot on the range? The guy shoots 2,000 bullets a day. You got to practice your skills. And if you don't, you're not going to be everything you can be. That was pretty damn depressing. Don't you think that I just said that?
You know, I was reading some descriptions of lawyers who had passed away and kind of their biographies being sent around on a listserv that I'm part of. And they were describing this one lawyer who had I think it was someone, a lawyer I'm sure you've heard of named Rex Carr.
Yeah.
But it could be, but I think this is who they were describing. And they were saying about one particular trial that went on a long time, that he had one witness on the witness stand and cross-examined him for, I think it was either 5 or 6 months.
Wow.
And there are stories I've heard about that occasionally where people are on the stand cross-examined over very prolonged periods of time like that. And I think about kind of the modern sort of fast trial approach where people are trying to put, you know, confining witnesses to 20 minutes or right. less. Where do you come down on that? And how does that kind of mesh with your approach to cross?
Look, I've done really long crosses, multiple day crosses, and I've done crosses that were 10 questions. The question is, what are you crossing on? That's the first question. How important is it? If it's not important, why are you talking about it? So then the next question is, what juror, what listener do you have, judge, jury, whatever? Can they tolerate a long cross? And more, the consensus is juries are not listening as well as they once did. When I started 45 years ago in a small South Georgia town, a jury trial was a damn day to take off and go to court and watch the lawyers try the case. I mean, people did that. No one can do that now, not even lawyers. We can't take time off to go watch somebody else. Then the third factor, I think, is, so are you earning your cross as you go? Don't tell me you're hitting 50%. That's a terrible cross. Don't tell me you're hitting 70. That's still not very good. That means 30% of this jury's time has been wasted. So my answer is, look, if you have a cross that truly is worthwhile and it's going to be 2 hours, then your cross should be 2 hours. And if you have a cross that's really worthwhile and it's 3 days, then your cross should be 3 days. There's no time limit on these things. And here's the biggest thing. When witnesses start volunteering, that cross is going substantially longer, substantially longer. I just did a deposition 2-3 weeks ago of a quotes expert witness is actually in California, up in Sacramento. And the direct might have been 10 minutes and the cross was an hour and a half because he started volunteering and now I'm turning him into my damn expert. And I have him ratifying all but the conclusion of our expert. He's saying, yeah, that's an appropriate test. He's saying, yeah, that test was done correctly. Yes, the methodology was good on that. I'm affirming my expert with their expert. And my expert hadn't taken a stand yet. Now, to me, that's an hour and a half good cross. They don't know what to do with him now. Now they don't want him as a witness. Well, guess who's endorsing him as a witness now? You know, I don't know how the judge is going to handle that, but it's going to force probably a settlement. They sure are happy to take my call now. Before the deposition, they didn't give a damn about me calling from Utah. And now we're on a, hey, Raj, how you doing basis, you know? I can always tell when I've gotten under somebody's skin where it just blew back on them. Boy, they want to look me up. They want to ask me questions about my personal life. They're fixing to get their wallet out.
So, Roger, in the classes you teach, are you going back to in-person, by the way, or are you still doing them remotely?
We're back. We're back. We have two in Hawaii in August. I was always reluctant about Hawaii. I had to cancel because of the pandemic, a live one. I had to cancel because of a volcano one time, a live one. So I believe in omens. And I thought, you know, the powers that be are telling me don't show up on that island. So my son, who is an excellent trial lawyer, Matt, put in to do one in Hawaii. So, okay, we do that. And I should have known this. I didn't know it. I'll admit it. Hawaii is halfway to Australia. So we've been trying to teach Australian lawyers for a long time, and we always misfire because it's like 16 hours difference or something. And taught a lot of people from England. That's only 5, 6, 7, 8 hours, depending on where you're at. So we're always able to do that. But the distance was just too big with Australia. So Australia lawyers bought 5 of the 8 seats immediately. And they were a day ahead, I guess. Anyhow, they were ahead of Americans. So we had a lot of angry American lawyers. We didn't even get a chance to get a seat. So we're doing a second one. And that's, I think, either sold out or almost sold out. Then we do an East Coast swing in October. September, I got a bunch of trial sets. So we try to mix them up and then find times when we can do them. I love the in-person, but the travel just kills you.
Can we get you to come to Maine?
Yeah. As I mentioned in an email to you that I'm sure you didn't read, and I say that because I didn't get a response, but I know you're a trial lawyer. You're busy.
If it had exclamation points in it, I would have responded. So,
well, I think you take the record.
I thought I did respond, but
no, you probably did. We have some kin up there in Maine, and I know that Maine is not a bad drive from Boston because we've done that drive. And Boston, believe it or not, Salt Lake City to Boston is an easy flight. So we're happy to do that. Now, if you tell me you have some pheasants or chucker or quail or ducks in Maine to shoot, then the answer is absolutely we can do Maine.
Oh, yeah. We've got a big hunting culture here.
Yeah, but I'm talking about birds. I don't want to shoot any more animals.
Well, turkeys.
Man, if you ever go on turkey hunt?
I'm not a hunter, but I have friends who do a lot of turkey hunting.
Okay. Well, you have friends that sit for long periods of time in the cold and don't move because turkeys are smart as they can be, and they are wily. And so you have to be very, very patient. Now, look at me. Do I look like...
What about ducks?
I'm good with ducks. Ducks are appointment shooting. Yeah.
We have ducks, too.
Yeah, ducks come in half an hour after sunrise. So you can almost set your clock by that. So I love shooting ducks. So you get up early, you go out, shoot ducks, get cleaned up, go to work.
I'll set you up with someone who can take you duck hunting if you come to Maine. How about that?
Yeah, that's a real perk for me. I mean, I can distinctly remember as a young lawyer, I had my suit under my waders last day of duck season. and we get into a mess of birds, and so we're shooting a little more than we thought we were, and we're going to run a little late. This is before cell phones and all that. So my waders leaked a little bit, so I'm walking down the hallway of the courthouse, and my feet are going, squish, squish, squish. My socks are all wet, and no one says anything. Everybody hears it. Everybody's looking around. They can't figure out what's going on, and a bailiff comes over to me, good friend, still good friend. He said, is that you squishing? I said, yeah. He said, did you go duck hunting this morning? I said, yeah. He says, I want some. Or I'm telling the judge. So, yeah, I love appointment shooting.
Well, we'd love to see you here in the great state of Maine or Northeast. We'll try to set that up offline. We can let our listeners know if you're heading this way so they can sign up.
Here's the deal. I don't know how many more cases I'm going to try. They keep getting settled. Maybe I should rub up against Raul and, you know, get some of that. I'm going to court stuff. So, but I know I can teach a bunch more And so we're trying to find that balance of let me try as many as I can. I'm not done yet, but I recognize the candle's burned down some, but I can teach until I'm completely demented. So we're happy to teach anywhere.
Roger's an excellent, excellent teacher, and he's taught, I think, almost every lawyer in our firm. We've added a few lawyers, so we're going to schedule another time with you, Roger, for them as well.
Yeah, I actually told Brian that I thought we should do that live just to see how everybody thinks live versus Zoom.
Yeah.
The experience we had with you all, I don't know, we did six or seven separate groups with you, was always very, very positive for us. But there is that live factor of you can't replicate on Zoom.
No, that's true. But the experience was more exhausting and more learning in that 2 or 3 day time period than any trial or anything else I've done. So I think I would highly recommend it to anybody who's aspiring to just get better at the practice of law and in being a trial lawyer. And so, Roger, for anybody who wants to...
You were exhausted because you were working your tail off.
Yeah,
and 100%. That's what the clinics do. They require you to work hard. And most people kick into gear, and you saw it in your group. People the second day were 10 times better than the first day. And I don't know what it is. People go home, they have a glass of wine, they go to sleep, they come back, they're better. And we can always mark how good a clinic was by the difference between day one and day two.
So Roger, if anybody wants to reach out to you to see if they can schedule a session with you, how should they get a hold of you?
You know, it's online, Dodd Law Clinic, but my personal email, well, my professional personal email is doddlaw@doddlaw.com. And just send me a real quick, don't make it a 2-page damn email, folks. 2 paragraphs, I need some information, I'll get you to the right person. Send me two pages. I might just tell you, can you summarize this in 2 paragraphs, or I may just not read it.
Make sure you put in a lot of exclamation points, though.
Well, listen, I mean, that's so California. And now I realize that's passive aggressive for what he's doing to his child.
That's so funny.
No, I'm totally with your child on this now. I was forced to do some stuff, and guess what? I don't do it anymore. And I don't care that it helps society, Raul. I'm not doing it.
Just saying, I was forced to read as a kid. I still read.
I think so. If there's one problem that Gen Zers have, it's not that they do too much.
It's true.
As the father of three myself, I can assure you they're not overburdened. It's definitely good for them to be doing some forced labor, in my humble opinion.
Everything in moderation, but I grew up in a neighborhood where every male, every older male had been to World War II, and they thought our generation sucked at work ethic. And every generation since then, I hear the same thing. These guys won't work. They don't have work ethic. I say it all the time with these new lawyers. We finally got a Cracker Jack, and she just works my tail off. I won't say uncle, but I sure want to say uncle at the end of some days. She'll say, can I ask you one more question? I'm like, God, I was so close to a glass of wine. I could taste it. And of course, you have to say, of course you can. You know, you can't say you can outwork me. You can't ever give in to it.
Well, thank you, Roger, for agreeing to do the podcast. This has been really great, and it's great to meet you.
You guys are fun.
Look forward to seeing you in person at the end of July in LA.
Yeah. You're going to be there then.
I will.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's great.
All right. Thank you, Roger.
You're welcome.
See you soon.
Thank you, bud.
For more information about today's guests and the topics discussed on the show, please visit our website at www.elevate.net. That's ELAWBATE.net, where you'll find guest profiles and show notes, and you can continue the conversation by joining our Facebook group. And if you enjoyed today's show, we hope that you'll subscribe and consider giving us a 5-star review. So for now, keep on working to elevate your trial law practice, and we'll see you back again soon.